So now we will move to the main agenda of the day, and I do have an opening statement that I will make. This is the Carpinteria Sanitary District ACL complaint number R3, 2015-0011, item 22. This is the time and place for a hearing of a Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board in to consider adoption of an administrative civil liability order against Carpinteria Sanitary District. This hearing will be conducted in accordance with the hearing procedures that were provided to the parties. Designated parties as follow: Regional Board Prosecution Team and Carpinteria Sanitary District. The designated parties and their witnesses are subject to cross-examination, and the prosecution staff will be allowed 45 minutes for their presentation, including opening statement, direct testimony, and cross-examination, and 5 minutes for closing statement. Carpinteria Sanitary District will be allowed 45 minutes as well for their presentation, including opening statement, direct testimony, cross-examination, and 5 minutes for their closing statements. All our persons are considered interested persons, and will be allowed 3 minutes. The chair may provide additional time at its discretion, and we will use a timer with the helpful assistance of my vice chair here. And board members, the advisory team, and staff counsel may ask questions to clarify testimony of witness at the end of each witness testimony. So feel free when a witness has given their presentation, you know, you flag to me, I'll go left to right, and then I'll switch right to left on the next one, but I'll make just one pass, so make sure you have your questions all prepared. Thank you. For the purpose of this hearing, the function of staff and counsel are separated. Prosecution staff who are proposing these actions have had no communication with the board members or board advisors other than for non-controversial procedural matters. The board counsel has not advised the prosecution team in this matter. For this hearing, the prosecution team consists of Mr. Michael Thomas, Assistant Executive Officer, Mr. Harvey Packard, Thea Tyrone, Todd Stanley, Leo Sarmiento, Jim Fisher, and Dr. Matthew Bufflinden. They are advised by Julie Macedo and David Boyers, counsel for the State Water Resource Control Board Office of Enforcement. For this hearing, the board's advisory team consists of Jessica Jarre, who is on the phone, I believe, correct? Lori Oaken and Tamron Austin, counsel for the State Water Resource Control Board Office Chief Counsel, Mr. Ken Harris, Executive Officer, Lisa McCain, and John Roque. Each person who testifies at this hearing shall begin by stating his or her name and address, unless the address has already been given. All persons who may testify at this hearing, please stand, even if you do not plan to testify but are involved in this matter. Thank you. Raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you solemnly swear that this testimony which you will give in this matter is the truth? Answer, I do.
I do.
Thank you very much. The order of presentation at this hearing will be as follows. Number one, opening statements by prosecution staff and the Carpinteria Sanitation District. Number two, Central Coast Water Board prosecution staff case in chief with cross-examination by the Carpinteria Sanitary District. Number three, other interested persons who will be allowed 3 minutes. And then closing statement by the Carpinteria Sanitary District and prosecution staff. Cross-examination of each witness will occur after the witness direct testimony, and the party offering the witness may then offer redirect testimony as well. At close of a hearing, the board members and advisory team may adjourn to closed session to deliberate on the evidence as authorized by Government Code Section 11126. After conclusion of a deliberation, the board will resume open session and provide its ruling. So when you're presented, please state your name, address, affiliation, and whether you have taken the oath before testifying. And at this time, evidence should be introduced on the following issue: whether the regional board should issue, reject, or modify the proposed administrative civil liability. So I will now begin the hearing from Mr. Harris. Okay. So we'll start with open statement from the prosecution staff.
Good morning, Chairman Wolf and members of the board. I am Harvey Packard of Water Board staff. I'm on the prosecution team. I have taken the oath, and I am introducing the enforcement team's presentation this morning. We're here as a result of the enforcement team's issuing a complaint against Carpinteria Sanitary District, alleging 6 violations of their NPDES permit. Carpinteria and the enforcement team have had discussions regarding these violations and are in agreement regarding several issues. We agree that 5 of the violations are subject to mandatory minimum penalties, and regarding the loss of disinfection incident, we agree on several circumstances of the event, including the volume discharged. There are areas of disagreement, mainly whether the loss of disinfection violation is subject to mandatory minimum penalties versus a discretionary penalty, and if subject to a discretionary penalty, the amount of the appropriate penalty and as considered under the enforcement policy factors. The MMP versus discretionary penalty is an important issue for the enforcement team. As detailed in our written submittals, we maintain that the loss of disinfection violation was not a violation of the MMP statute, and therefore, if there is to be a penalty, it must be of the discretionary variety. You will note that this is not the largest penalty we've recommended to the board by far, and as we say in our brief, Carpinteria's facility is generally well run and they do have a good reputation. We did make a good faith effort to settle this matter with Carpinteria without a hearing, but there are several important issues that compel us as enforcement staff to bring this matter to the board. One is the integrity of the Water Board's regulatory program. The board, through a public process, adopted this NPDES permit. Once that process is finished and the requirements established, staff is tasked with monitoring and enforcing compliance with the permit. There is no disagreement that the facility lost capability to disinfect effluent on October 3rd, 2012. Carpinteria argues that this violation is minor and that the most should be penalized with a $3,000 minimum penalty. We maintain that this violation is significant enough to warrant a more substantial penalty. Secondly, deterrence is an important element of enforcement. Here's a quote from the enforcement policy. Enforcement is a critical ingredient in creating the deterrence needed to encourage the regulated community to anticipate, identify, and correct violations. Appropriate penalties and other consequences for violations offer some assurance of equity between those who choose to comply with the requirements and those who violate them. It also improves public confidence when government is ready, willing, and able to back up its requirements with action. Third, this is an important case to demonstrate the need for facilities to have proper treatment system safeguards, including monitoring systems, alarms, and redundancies to ensure compliance with their permits. I'd also point out that there is a separation of functions even within Water Board staff. Permitting staff draft permits, review monitoring reports, and do initial review and follow up on violations. We have enforcement staff who are separate from permitting staff in order to pursue enforcement objectively and impartially. Our presentation today will focus on reviewing the technical and legal reasons why our recommended penalty for this violation is appropriate. This time, I'll turn the time over to Dr. Matthew Beflavin of the State Water Board Office of Enforcement.
Just for the record, I think we need to announce that Ms. Cervantes is now present.
And also, I apologize for mispronouncing Carpinteria. This is my Frenchism. You may have a few more examples later on today of my mispronunciations. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Matthew Scott Beflavin. I am an engineer, a senior engineer with the State Water Resources Control Board, and I have taken the oath. Let me tell you a little bit about my background first before we get into the testimony of the case. I have a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering.
So this is intended to be a witness narrative testimony, which is permitted under the hearing procedures.
Yes, please proceed. Could you speak louder, please? Yes.
Good morning. I'm William Carter on behalf of Carpinteria Sanitary District. I was under the impression, and I apologize, that Carpinteria would have an opportunity to make an opening statement before there was a presentation of evidence to the board. And if that's not the case, I apologize. I would, though, make a motion, since all these individuals are under oath, and we are making a record and we want to be as accurate as possible. I would be making a record to exclude all witnesses who are not testifying. They would have to wait outside, except for one representative of the client and one expert. That way we can assure that we have a full and accurate and candid questioning or cross-examination of these witnesses. That's standard procedure in every court of law, every administrative proceeding. I would ask for all witnesses who are not testifying be excluded until such time they've been called, and admonished not to discuss what they testified to in here during the hearing.
Would the prosecution team like to respond before I advise the chair?
My response would be that these proceedings are not conducted like a court, like a trial, they're much different. And so, we would prefer that our witnesses be available to hear the testimony of all the other witnesses, to give perspective and context to their own statements, and to be able to provide answers to the questions that the board members may have.
Dr. Wolf, that's also my recommendation. That is the way the boards conduct their administrative proceedings. It's consistent with administrative law, and it also allows the board members to address questions to the panel as a whole. In some cases, it's not necessarily clear to us who the best person is to respond to a question, and we leave it to the parties to designate which witness will address which issues. So my recommendation is not to exclude the witnesses, and if you agree, that on the record.
Yes, I do agree not to exclude the witnesses.
And then on the issue of opening statements, the hearing procedures are silent. It says that each party has a total of 45 minutes to use as they wish. So it's up to you whether the discharger will be allowed to present the opening statement before the prosecution team presents its evidence. It could be helpful, but it's totally up to the chair.
Please proceed.
Thank you. So once again, my name is Matthew Beflavin. I was telling you a little bit about my background. I have a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from UC Santa Barbara. I have a master's degree from the UCLA School of Public Health and Environmental Health Science, and I have my doctorate degree in environmental science and engineering. I am a licensed civil engineer in the state of California, and I've been, prior to my working at the State Board as a supervising engineer, I worked at the North Coast Region Water Board for 12 years. So today I'm going to discuss the enforcement policy and its application for the penalty calculation. I know many of you may not be very familiar with the enforcement calculations, but in the interest of time, I'll go through the policy, but I'll skip a few steps that we're in agreement with the discharger. I want to point out that the largest difference between the prosecution team and the district is the estimate of harm for the discharge. So when I get to that step and that factor and going over the enforcement policy, I'll spend a little bit more time discussing the harm of the discharge. So first, let's talk about the violations. The violations that we're seeking a penalty for is the discharge of the undisinfected effluent that occurred for over 5.5 hours. This discharge started approximately at 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:08 in the morning, and lasted until approximately 9:45 in the morning on October 3rd. There's other violations, including failure to take all reasonable steps to minimize or prevent discharge, failure to provide safeguards, and failure to monitor. However, we're using our prosecution discretion and not seeking penalties for these violations. So California Water Code Section 13385 describes several factors that the board must consider in ACL Act complaints. The enforcement policy provides directions on how to weigh those factors in 13385. There are 10 steps to these factors, and some of the steps have several factors within them. So I'm going to walk us through and apply the enforcement policy for this incident. The first step is determining the potential for harm for the discharge violation. Now, there's three factors in this step. There's the harm or potential harm for beneficial uses, there's the characteristics of the discharge, factor two, and then there's factor three, the susceptibility to cleanup and abatement. I'm going to take these factors a little out of order. Hopefully this won't confuse you. So the first factor I'm going to talk about is the susceptibility to cleanup. We agree with the district that this discharge wasn't susceptible to cleanup, and therefore it scored in a one, and according to the enforcement policy, and there's no reason to further discuss that. I'm next going to go to factor two, which is actually the characteristics of the discharge. This factor essentially looks at the material discharged in isolation. Is it toxic, and how harmful is the waste? In other words, it's the degree of toxicity of the discharge. This factor has a scale from 0 to 4, which is assigned based on the risk or threat of the discharge. It goes from negligible, 0, up to a 4, which is significant.
So what?
What is undisinfected secondary effluent? So primary and secondary treatment at wastewater treatment plants removes a lot of pollutants, particularly suspended solids and organic materials. However, primary and secondary treatment results in only small reductions in human pathogens. Bacteria and viruses remain, and these include norovirus, cryptosporidium, and giardia.
Until
very recently, we didn't have methods to detect human pathogens, and the water quality standards are based on indicators of sewage. And we call these indicators fecal indicator bacteria. Typically and historically, they have been total and fecal coliforms and Enterococcus. Enterococcus is a subset of these bacteria, and it's really the best indicator of the presence of sewage and of pathogens. Now, since we're dealing with bacteria, there's a large uncertainty in any one measurement for bacteria counts. This is because coliform and bacteria aren't evenly distributed through the water column. So you may take two samples and you'll have a wide range of what the results are. And I cover this in my next slide. So we required in our 13267 letter to the district to do an impact assessment for public health in the ecosystem. The district at this time had tested their undisaffected secondary effluent at the treatment plant. Their result for total coliform was 160 MPM, that's the most probable number, per 100 milliliters. Now the range of this, the confidence of where that true medium is, actually lies somewhere between 40,000 MPM and 460,000 MPM. So it's a large range of uncertainty. And like I said, it's because coliform bacteria are not evenly distributed in the water column. And your samples, even taken at the same time and using the best methods possible, will have a large range in the results. Fecal coliform, their result was 92,000 MPM. And now we compare that to the effluent limit. The permit states that the effluent limit is an instantaneous maximum of only 2,300 MPM per 100 milliliters. As you can see, the results from this undisaffected secondary effluent are well above the effluent limit in the permit. So now we're going to go over the score for factor two. Once again, I mentioned that the scale goes from 0 to 4. We selected a 2, a moderate risk or potential to receptors. Now this is based on the discharger's analysis that the discharge material has the potential to contain high level of human pathogens. Now I feel the prosecution team, we could have selected a factor of 3, and that would have been consistent with other sewage discharges. Even in cases where there's been a discharge of highly diluted sewage into the environment, a case where you have a sewer system during a rain event, where there's a high amount of inflow and infiltration into the system and that dilutes the sewage, the regional water boards throughout the state have consistently scored this characteristics of the discharge as a 3, an above moderate risk. In this case, since the discharge lasted for 5 hours and it was did go through other treatment processes, we determined a appropriate score would be a 2. Now the next thing I'm going to talk about is factor 1, a step 1. And like I said before, this is where we have the most disagreement with the district. The harm considers or potential harm that may result from exposure to the pollutants and the contaminants in the discharge. As we've stated in our briefs, there was no receiving water monitoring data collected during the discharge or after the discharge, even though the permit required monitoring for 7 days after the loss of disinfection. Now, the presence or absence of such monitoring data is not a primary determining factor regarding harm. In many enforcement cases, particularly dealing with spills, we usually lack that such data, and a general qualitative assessment of harm is conducted. Even if there was comprehensive monitoring data, evidence of direct harm is rare. However, as in response to our 13267 order, the district did conduct an impact analysis, and we used the information provided by the district, as well as other sources, particularly from the literature, to determine the potential harm. In this case, the score goes from 0 to 5, with 0 once again being negligible and 5 being a major impact. So let's first look at the outfall location. Here's a map of Carpinteria, and I put a little pin on the map of the approximate location of the outfall. It's approximately 1,000 feet offshore and a water depth of 25 feet, and it's off of the State Carpinteria Beach. Next step I'm going to look at is the beneficial uses. I'm going to focus on the two beneficial uses that were most likely affected by this discharge and the receiving water standards. The first one is water contact recreation, as defined in the permit and in the basin plan. This is a zone that's bounded by the shoreline and a distance of up to 1,000 feet from the shoreline or to the 30-foot depth contour, whichever is further from the shoreline. So it's important to note that the outfall in this case is actually located in the zone for water contact recreation. The next beneficial use that was likely affected is shellfish harvesting. Now, as defined in the basin plan, Shellfish harvesting is actually a combination, I'm using a combination of four closely related beneficial uses. And it's been defined as an existing use from Coal Oil Point to Rincon Point have been designated for shellfish harvesting. Now, it's important to note that when I get further into this discussion, that there is no distinction in the basin plan between recreational or commercial uses for shellfish harvesting standards. It's that these beneficial uses exist and they need to be protected. So this table shows the relevant water quality standards for water contact on that left-hand column and for shellfish. The middle column shows the commercial shellfish standard that the California Public Health uses for commercial shellfisheries. And then the last column there, I'm calling it the ABCL analysis. This is the consultant's work that the discharger did to analyze and estimate the potential harm for the discharge. So on the left-hand side, I have the total fecal coliform, single maximum, 1,000 for total coliform and 400 for fecal coliform, and then Enterococcus. And in the shellfish, the medium value, the permit limits is 70. Now, ABCL analysis ran two essentially analyses. They took an ocean sample, and to estimate the receiving water limits, on the left-hand side, they assumed that dilution of 93:1. So that results in 1,720 in total coliform, and the second one is for fecal coliform. They also took the sample and spiked it with ocean at a dilution of 93:1. And that result came into 490, and for fecal and coliform, 330. And the reason why this 93:1 dilution is important, because that's what we assume occurs within the mixing zone that's allowed by the permit. You have that much dilution of the effluent until it reaches the receiving water zone. Now, considering the variability of these coliform and bacteria counts, it's our opinion that the shellfish standard was violated in the receiving waters by this discharge, and it's likely that the water contact standard was also violated. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about the ABCL report. So once again, this report was created by the district consultants in response to our 13267 order requiring an impact analysis. This report concluded that there was no exceedances of water quality limits and no adverse impacts. However, we find that this report was incomplete and inaccurate in many aspects. First of all, there was not an analysis for the shellfish beneficial use. The shellfish standard and receiving water standards were not mentioned in the report at all. There was an incomplete analysis because there was no analysis of Enterococcus. Enterococcus is the best indicator for human pathogens and sewage and receiving waters. So the failure to conduct an Enterococcus sampling hampers their analysis. The ABCL report only partially recited the recreational standard. They cited the higher limit of 10,000 MPN receiving water limit when they should have been using the 1,000 MPN limit because there is a presence of fecal coliform in a ratio higher than 0.1. Now, the district and the ABCL report states that there possibly could have been some additional disinfection in the chlorine contact tank after the chlorine pump failed to deliver chlorine to this tank. And also that there might have been further UV disinfection since there's approximately a 3 hour to a 1 hour holding time within this tank where it would be exposed to sunlight. In our rebuttal, we noted that the weather conditions on that morning was overcast in the area, therefore likely eliminating any UV disinfection, and that we believe that the statement that if there was any leftover chlorine in the contact chamber, that there would have minimal disinfection on the coliform and more likely minimal impact on the human pathogens that may be present. The next part disagreement we have with the ABCL report is that they used the wrong fate and transport monitoring approach. They used a dredging model for wastewater effluent. Now the parameters for dredging material are much different than wastewater effluent. They also used a near-field mixing zone model to describe the far-field effects. I'll go into that a little bit more. So here's the document on the left is what ABCL used. It's a joint document between EPA and Army Corps of Engineers. And like I said, it's evaluation of discharged dredging material. Dredging material is very different physical properties than effluent. It sinks. It has entirely different characteristics in the water column. Marine waste outfalls, which we cited in our rebuttal, describes how wastewater reacts. This is an example of a water outfall. Down here we have the diffuser and the effluent coming out of the diffuser. In this mixing zone, which is defined as the permit as the 93:1 mixing zone, you have buoyant forces and momentum changes that create this plume. Wastewater effluent is essentially fresh water compared to salt water. So it's buoyant. It flows up to the surface of the water. This combination of the buoyancy forces and the momentum changes creates turbulent mixing in the zone, and you get entrainment with the surrounding seawater, and this is where you get that rapid dilution of the effluent. That happens rapidly, and in my opinion, this occurred within a minute or so after the discharge from the effluent pipe, and the plume would have surfaced within approximately 100 feet within the location of the discharge, within the location of the outfall. Actually, let me go back to that slide. So this is the near field dilution. It's really close to the outfall. Now, once it passes this near field, engineers call this a far field. And the processes that happen to dilute the plume further into far field are very different from what happens in the near field mixing zone. Once it passes this zone that has the buoyant and turbulent forces, the plume only dilutes by diffusion, and it's carried by along ocean currents. Since we're in the near shore environment, it's my opinion that this plume would have persisted for a substantial amount of time, a period of hours, and would have drifted towards shore until it reached a more turbulent zone like the surf zone. And there once again would have been mixed up and diluted even further. So finally, the district in their brief claims that since other agencies didn't require additional actions, that it supports ABCL's analysis and their conclusions. So however, the district acknowledged that they did not have a return call from Santa Barbara County until the day after the event. And furthermore, the analysis that was done by the Department of Public Health is only for the active commercial shell fishery, which is located 13 miles away from the outfall. Now, the Department of Public Health did a very crude calculation on the area of impact. It serves their purposes, particularly since the only active commercial fishery at this time is located over 13 miles away, and so we can understand their concern. However, at the water boards, we're concerned about protecting the beneficial uses of the water, and these are existing uses throughout the area in the water column. So that's factor one, and that's, like I said, I spent a little more time on that factor because that's where we have the most disagreement with the discharger. So once again, the scale for this factor goes from 0 to 5, and we selected 2, a below moderate threat to beneficial uses. And this is because The receiving water limits for shellfish, we believe, were exceeded, and it was likely that the water contact recreation receiving water limit was also exceeded. So step two, I'll move a little bit faster through these other steps in the enforcement policy. This is the assessment for discharge violations. Here we talk about the deviation requirement. Often the prosecution team assigns a major for violating the prohibition against unpermitted discharges. However, since this discharge lasted for 5.5 hours, we were conservative and selected moderate for the deviation from requirement. The high volume discharge, instead of assigning the maximum of 10 gallons per gallon, we stipulated with the district to assign this as $2 per gallon. I'm going to skip step three in the enforcement policy because we're not prosecuting non-discharge violations. So moving on to step four, there's several adjustment factors to the penalty, culpability, cleanup and cooperation, and history of violations. These factors can increase or decrease the penalty amount. I'm going to talk first about the history of violations. Since we stipulated with the discharger that this should be a one, since there were no previous undisaffected violations from the district. Next, I'm going to talk about culpability. And general enforcement policy says that higher liabilities should result from intentional and negligent violations than for accidental or non-negligent violations. A first step is to identify any performance standards or, in their absence, prevailing industrial practice in the context of this violation. Now, the likely cause in this case was an airlock. However, the lack of alarm or an automated backup system contributed to the duration and the volume of the spill, and we scored it as a 1.1. At this stage, I'm going to pass the testimony over to Leo Sarmiento, and he'll talk a little bit about the treatment plan and the alarm.
Can you use the microphone, please?
Excuse me, when would cross-examination be for the district?
It's up to the chair. You can have the board questions and or the cross-examination after each witness, or you can save all the questions until the end of the presentation, both for the discharger and for the board questions. And I don't know if the district has a preference on whether to cross-examine each witness after they finish their part of the presentation or whether you'd prefer to wait till the end. I would suggest you wait until after the board asks its questions because they may ask a lot of the same questions without using your allotted time.
I'll defer to that. Thank you.
So I think because there's quite a bit of material being presented, it would help if, you know, my colleagues here have an opportunity after each of a presentation to ask questions because, you know, we're taking a lot of notes and I think while it's fresh in our mind, that would be best. So at this time, and of course we'll hold off the total allotted time, but I would like to give the opportunity for my fellow board members, if you had specific questions to that very first presentation that was made before we go to your step. So I will start with my right. And
I think
then
Mr. Boyers is trying to say something.
Oh, I'm sorry.
To the extent that you might indulge me.
I will indulge you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. My recommendation is that you allow for the entire presentation to be heard. There is some continuity and some context in tying in what Mr. Sarmiento is going to testify as to the culpability standard. And then Mr. Beplaven is actually going to go back and wrap it up. So, we're kind of maybe a little more than halfway through. So to the extent that that would be allowed by you, I would ask for that.
I'm going to look at my board member. We're fine with that? Okay, all right, so please proceed.
Good morning, board members, chair, and advisory team. My name is Leo Sarmiento, Water Resources Control Engineer with the State Water Resources Control Board Office of Enforcement, located at 1001 I Street in Sacramento. I am also licensed California Chemical Engineer, and I have taken the oath. I'm here today to support the prosecution team's assertion that the October 3rd, 2012 discharge of undisinfected effluent could have been prevented or minimized had the district installed a low dosage alarm system to alert operators of chlorination problems. I will provide information about my experience and tell you why the district violated the standard provisions of the NPDES permit. And I'll finish why explaining why a low dosage chlorine alarm system is considered industry standard practice, especially at facilities like Carpinteria that only staff the plant for 8 hours per day. I have over 3 years of experience as grade 3 certified wastewater treatment plant operator at the City of Palo Alto's regional tertiary wastewater treatment plant. I received numerous hours of training on standard operating procedures for equipment at the plant, including the chlorination system. Our plant was equipped way back then, 25 years ago, with a chlorine system alarm that notified operators of deficiencies, malfunctions, or hazardous situations, including low or high chlorine dosages. I also have more than 16 years of regulatory experience as a water resources control engineer at both regional and state water boards, writing NPDES and WDR permits, and conducting dozens of non-compliance and enforcement inspections at wastewater treatment plants. For routine compliance inspections, we typically check areas such as adequate staffing, discuss unit processes, monitoring systems, etc. For incident-related investigations like the chlorination failure at the district's wastewater treatment plant, we conduct detailed investigation as to the cause of the incident. The NPDES permit standard provisions require the district to provide all reasonable steps to minimize or prevent any discharge that has reasonable likelihood of adversely affecting human health or the environment, and provide safeguards to assure maximal compliance with all terms and conditions of its discharge permit. In this case, the district has to identify possible situations that could cause upset, overflow, bypass, or other noncompliance that could lead to unauthorized discharge and to provide the necessary safeguards for a reliable disinfection process. Industry standard practices are generally accepted set of methods of practices or practices within an industry. Alarm systems are considered industry standard practices that provide safeguards of key treatment components in wastewater treatment plants. Alarms are critical components, especially for facilities that remotely monitor plant operations via SCADA systems like the district's wastewater treatment plant. By providing a low dosage chlorine alarm, operators would be notified of any chlorination failures that could be caused by chemical pump failure, absence of adequate chlorine supply, debris clogging in feed lines or pumps, airlocking, loss of pump prime or chemical supply. I would also point out that the district's technical report on page 7, the cause of failure indicates, and I quote, "The chlorination pump inlet does not appear to be flooded at all times, i.e., low liquid levels in the tank may not be higher than the elevation at the inlet of the pump. This can cause or can create an increased risk for airlocking or loss of prime," end of quote. This admission of risk further illustrates the critical nature of having a safeguard in place such as low chlorine dosage alarm to notify operators, which the district did not provide. An example of published industry standard practice specific for chlorination systems was published on the SWRCB's website entitled Manual for Wastewater Chlorination and Dechlorination Practices, which is Exhibit 6 of our evidence list. The purpose of issuing this manual was to provide regulatory agencies, consulting engineers, and treatment plant operators with recommended chlorination and dechlorination practices. The manual focuses on the use of compressed liquid molecular chlorine, but is applicable to any facility with a chlorination system, including those facilities like the district that use hypochlorite disinfection system. The manual states on page 51, and I quote, every chlorination facility should have an alarm system that adequately alerts the operators in the event of deficiencies, malfunction, or hazardous situations related to chlorine supply, chlorine monitoring equipment, chlorine leaks, and chlorine residual. The manual also specifies utilization of monitoring equipment, such as chlorine residual analyzers at the end of the contact chamber and recording of chlorine flow through the chlorinator. As a certified wastewater plant operator, it was crucial that I was alerted as soon as possible about any potential equipment or process problems to ensure continuous and reliable operations to avoid any non-compliance issues, including violations of our discharge permit. Based on my cumulative experience as a certified wastewater plant operator and board staff, and in my expert opinion, chlorination process is a critical treatment component that should be continuously monitored with an alarm system that would alert operators to respond for corrective actions and return to normal process operation. This course of action is considered industry standard practice. District violated standard provisions in its NPDES permit by not having such an alarm. Had there been an alarm as safeguard that could have immediately notified plant operators of low chlorine condition in chlorine contact tank, this type of unauthorized discharge could have been prevented or minimized. Thank you.
So continuing on, I only have a few more slides for this presentation to go through the rest of the enforcement policy. Cleanup and cooperation. This is the extent to which the discharger voluntarily cooperated in returning to compliance and correcting the environmental damage. In this case, the discharger created an alarm a few weeks after the event. It was cooperative in responding for our request for information. However, it failed to complete the required monitoring in the permit. A discharger that fails to comply with its permit should not be given the maximum reduction in any recommended penalty. Therefore, the proper prosecution team proposes a score of 0.9, which slightly reduces the penalty. I'm going to skip over steps 5. Which is the term of the base liability, and step 6, which is the ability to pay, since the district agrees that they have the ability to pay the proposed penalty. And moving on to step 7, other factors that justice may require. One of these costs, one of the factors is staff costs. We calculated the staff costs at the time the ACLC was issued and excludes the cost of several members of the prosecution team. Step 8, the economic benefit. This includes the cost of the alarm and failure to monitor the receiving waters. There is a difference between the district and our estimate of the economic benefit, and we believe the main difference is that the district did not include staff time to collect the samples for 7 days at 2 different locations in their estimate of economic benefit. All right, so the final steps. We'll discuss the minimum and maximum liability for this discharge violation. The minimum liability by the enforcement policy is 10% more than economic benefit, which we estimate is $28,000. The maximum penalty is defined by statute, and that's $2,978,960. Step 10, the final liability amount, is what we're proposing for this discharge. So I know today I've talked a lot about the steps and factors in the calculation of the penalty and in the enforcement policy. Once again, our biggest disagreement with the discharger is the assessment of harm to the beneficial uses. It's up to you to decide if we had applied the enforcement policy appropriately and if the proposed fine is reasonable for this discharge. That ends our testimony. We can take questions now.
Thank you. So you're done with your open statements?
Yes. Right,
thank you. So I would like now to give the opportunity to my fellow board members to ask questions. And this time I will start on my right.
Kathleen Thomasberg. I want some clarification, if you could, please. I was listening to your description of the effluent coming from the wastewater treatment plant. Thank you. Going out 100 feet is the outfall outlet?
1,000 feet 1,000. From the shoreline, yes.
And 25 feet depth.
In water depth, correct.
Correct. So the concept is because of the heavier weight of the seawater, the lighter, fresher water, even if it is effluent, will float up, move to the shore, and then be eventually mixed. Is that correct?
Yes. That's my testimony, yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Ms. Cervantes?
Hi. I just wanted some more clarification on the economic benefit piece, if you could just sort of clarify the various calculations you included in reaching that dollar amount.
Yes. So there's two steps. There's the economic benefit for the alarm. So if you look at the proposed order and attachment A, the table covers two things. There's the avoided sampling and analysis of the receiving waters violations. So the permit requires that sampling occurred for 7 days at two different locations and five samples total. So that's what those estimate of the cost were. The second part of that table shows the delayed installation of the alarm and the economic benefit for that. Do you want me to break down the cost a little bit further? Okay.
Mr. Johnston.
Thank you. I have a few questions. Okay, so in the economic benefit analysis, the biggest chunk of the economic benefit is the failure to monitor. But if I understood correctly, in your explanation of the charges themselves, you explained that the prosecution team had exercised their discretion to not charge the failure to monitor as a violation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So the economic benefit is the discharger can't reap an economic benefit from their violation, and the violation of, or the potential violation of failing to monitor is not before us. So why would an economic benefit from failing to monitor be before us as part of this damage calculation?
David Boyers, counsel for the prosecution team. If I might just try to address that, board member Johnston. There's a legal theory that's called res judicata, and it basically precludes us from bringing a claim that is alleged in this complaint. And because we've alleged this as a violation, and it's discussed in the amended ACL complaint, and it's discussed in the proposed order, our opinion is that that violation is resolved through this proceeding, even though no penalty has been assessed. And because the violation has been alleged and resolved, it's appropriate to consider the economic benefit that arises from that violation in looking at the penalty methodology.
And I'm sorry, I heard that legal theory as res judicata, and I'm sure I got it wrong.
No, res judicata.
Oh, res judicata.
Right,
okay,
the claim is precluded from being alleged again. Right, and I think that district would you know, certainly argue that if after these proceedings, we issued another complaint and said, we are now going to penalize you for the failure to conduct monitoring. It would say, well, you alleged those claims in your complaint, and therefore you're precluded from bringing those again.
Okay, I think I understand. Now, you mentioned in your testimony that highly diluted sewage discharges in major rain events have consistently been scored a 3. Were those treated sewage, or were those something analogous to this?
It was raw sewage that was diluted through inflow infiltration during a rain event. So what happens in sewer systems is during large rain events, you get a lot of fresh water mixed with the sewage. And that mixes and dilutes that sewage down quite a bit in some cases. However, when there has been an overflow or a spill event of that, the regional water boards, and we cite two examples for this region, we consistently score that as a 3, mainly because that sewage has the potential to carry a high amount of pathogens.
Thank you. Now, I'm a little curious about the testimony around the design standard, it being a design standard for to have chlorine alarms, and the there was a quote from the wastewater treatment manual. I'm probably naming it incorrectly, and that referred. I believe the testimony said that actually that quote referred to liquid chlorine systems, but it was analogous, and I would just like to hear a little more about that, because some of the other words I've heard in the testimony around that was to deal with leaks and hazardous situations. I know the liquid chlorine has the potential. I mean, obviously, you don't want just want an alarm. Principally, you don't want an alarm for when it's not chlorinating. You want an alarm for when it's leaking and liable to kill your operators. So I'm trying to understand how that establishes that it's an industry standard to have a low chlorination alarm in a situation where you're using what I assume to be some sort of a dry powdered chlorine, something other than liquid chlorine.
The manual was intended during the time it was a lot of use of compressed gas, which is the liquid gas. And so there's a lot of concerns about protection of human health, protection for operators. And so that's why I pointed out that is the analogous here is that the hazardous nature of the chemical is also applicable for this hypochlorite solution, because it's also hazardous material. And so, and not only because for safety and health concerns of operators out there, but also for the process control. So that is what I'm referring to.
Okay, so, but the manual was specific to liquid chlorine systems?
Yes, it was designed, or it was intended for the use of liquid compressed gas, liquid chlorine.
And I guess the other question I have is, I'm aware from just reviewing the party's filings that there's I guess there's about 15 permitted municipal wastewater treatment systems in the region. A couple of them don't have chlorination, and I know prosecution distinguished those by having a deeper or further outfall. But of the others that do have chlorination systems, did the prosecution team attempt to ascertain how many of those did or did not have chlorination alarms?
No, I was not involved in that.
No, we haven't done that.
So you did not review to see which of the other systems did or did not have chlorination alarms in the region?
No, the permit requires that they have safeguards. The permits don't list out each and every alarm that's required.
I understand that. Okay. My question, just to be specific, right, is did in the course of its investigation the prosecution team or anyone on the prosecution team attempt to ask the other dischargers, the other permitted municipal wastewater treatment facilities in the region, as to whether they do or do not have chlorination alarms?
We did not.
Okay, thank you. That's the only questions I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. Mr. Flavin, did I get your name?
Buff Flavin.
Thank you. I'm interested in understanding the fate of the plume as it rose in the water column.
Yes, that's the near field mixing
and
zone.
Your contention is that currents would have moved it towards the shore.
Correct.
Okay, and then my question is, would it have reached the shoreline and could it have moved into that area that borders shore and actual beach?
Yes, so my experience, my professional experience dealing with waves and how near shore processes work is that the surface of the ocean slowly moves towards the coast. This is a combination of wind and wave action and the ocean swells and how those wave actions move particles. So, however, the dilution of that plume happens very slowly. So that plume, I believe, would be relatively stable until it reached the surf zone where there's breaking waves, and that turbulent action would further dilute the plume at that stage.
If I'm understanding you correctly, then that further dilution, which is pretty dynamic in the surf zone.
Correct.
That anything that may have actually landed on the beach would have been diluted sufficiently that we wouldn't be concerned about bacteria or human pathogens at that point.
It would have been highly diluted by when it reaches the surf zone and certainly reaches the shore throughout the surf zone, yes.
Okay. Then my second question is the shellfish operations. So I'm concentrating on harm right mm-hmm. now. So shellfish operations. During the 7 days following, aren't shellfish operations highly, highly monitored on an almost hourly basis?
No, I don't believe the frequency of monitoring is that frequent. I can't remember what the required monitoring frequency is in the permit. We did include that.
Would it be daily?
No, I don't believe it's daily. It depends on when they're actually harvesting the shellfish. I take that back. So if they're harvesting on a daily basis, then yes, I do believe they have to take a sample. But typically, they're not harvesting on a daily basis.
Okay. So during harvest time, which we don't know when that would be, but...
Correct.
So were there any shellfish operation reports of exceedances?
No, there were not.
Okay. My last question, and I think you answered this already, but I just want to clarify... In the economic benefit calculation, there were costs associated with staff time for sampling.
Correct.
And there was a total of 5 samples that would have been required in 7 days.
Correct.
And I'm going to assume, and just to confirm, that also includes the lab fees for the analysis of the samples.
Correct, yes.
Okay, because those can be substantial.
What's that?
Those can be substantial.
Right. But the district has a laboratory that does at least 2 of the tests that was required by the permit.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I do have one more question. As far as, and you may have answered this to Mr. Johnson's point, within the permit, there are monitoring requirements during the duration of the permit. And on occasion, staff will actually inspect systems. Is that triggered by an event, minor or major, those inspections, or are they routine? Do staff just circulate across the wastewater system within our region and take a look at what's going on any given day?
So this MPDS permit is considered a major facility, and EPA requires major facilities get inspected every other year or even annually if there are sufficient violations and it's on their watch list. So in addition to permitting staff or compliance staff reviewing the monitoring reports, they're supposed to visit and inspect the facility on a two-year cycle for major facilities like this.
Right, so my follow-up on that would be, would staff then, under the category of safeguards, look at or question or ask for information about what safeguards exist within the operating system?
They can, but as Leo testified earlier, that generally they're not looking at specific safeguards or alarm systems, but that generally could be part of their inspection.
So have you examined the inspection records that occurred prior to this event to see if staff noted what safeguards they observed?
We did review the inspection reports, and they were pretty general in nature, and didn't provide specific details about safeguards and alarms and that sort of details. The more thorough report that we included in that was the EPA compliance report, which I believe was in 2010. And that report was a little bit more detailed, but also I don't believe it touched on the issue of safeguards or alarms.
Okay, so let's say that there is a spill and there is a monitoring system or an alarm system in place. If the alarm fails, which can happen, then at that point staff would be looking specifically at the failure of the alarm system or whatever redundancies failed in case of a spill such as this?
Sure, when there's a failure of a process equipment, and we definitely, in a violation of the permit, staff will investigate that and work with the district to try to help determine, to try to determine what the cause of the alarm failure or the process failure as best we possibly can.
So I guess the, just to be sure I'm clear on this, the system's redundancy is a feature of the operation according to industry standards.
Correct, yes.
But we don't really look at that unless one of those systems fails. And so when we go and look at the operation as required by EPA, we don't look for those safeguards. We don't ask about those safeguards, and we don't record or observe or document our observations of what those safeguards might be.
Generally, the inspections or compliance inspections is of a more general nature and don't dive into those type of details about alarm systems.
Hmm. Okay, well, and is there an EPA checklist?
EPA has their contractors a checklist, and State Water Board also recently developed a checklist, and so in general, that's some of the things on the checklist. But unless there is a permit violation that would indicate that there might be a problem in the operations of the facility, like I said, those inspections are of a general nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would hope that the checklist is applied more effectively in the future. Because if it's on there, then perhaps this discussion could have occurred, because I agree with you that we do, our role is both in monitor, observing or assuring that the permit conditions are met, but we also are out there, you know, eyes on the system, and we have that technical expertise to observe, you know, how the system is actually set up for redundancy. And if it's on the checklist, then it would seem that the staff should have that dialogue, make sure they understand what those safeguards are.
Yes, I'm sure after this hearing that the enforcement staff and compliance staff will discuss those issues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mayor Delgado.
Yes, thank you. Regarding shellfish, the exhibit 8 of the prosecution's opening brief on page 8, this is a January 2014 Carollo report, I guess a consultant to Carpinteria Sanitary District. It says that the result of the discharge was a maximum 1.57 mile radius, looking, considering shellfish in this case. Does the prosecution team agree with that?
So that calculation was done by Public Health, and actually I included that calculation in one of our exhibits. And I can walk you through that if you want me to.
I just wanted to know if you agreed with that number, more or less.
No, because that calculation is done specifically for commercial fisheries by Public Health.
Right, that's what the figure says. It's
right.
No impact to shellfish growing due to a 1.57. So do you agree with the number, not the quality?
Oh, that the actual calculation,
yeah,
process they went through? Yes, that calculation I checked and that was accurate.
Okay, so I asked that because my two next questions are regarding that. Within that area of impact, that 1.57, generally mile radius, how much shellfish recreational harvesting occurs?
I don't have information on that.
Okay, wouldn't you want that information to assess potential harm to that beneficial use?
It would be nice to have information like that, but once again, we're interested in protecting the existing beneficial uses that have been defined by the permit and the basin plan.
So if you want to protect the beneficial use, don't you need to know what kind of use is occurring on some level?
At some level, when the basin plans were corrected, that analysis was done. And so that's why it's an existing beneficial use for that region.
So did that analysis in general, do you think, disclose the amount of recreation occurring in this area?
I don't have the history on that.
Okay. My other question about shellfish, let's say there was no recreational shellfish harvesting in this 1.57 mile radius. I don't understand shellfish biology, but is there an impact to the ecology of the shellfish regionally? Let's say there are larval reproduction going on in this area of the coast that might contribute to shellfish occurrence available for recreation harvesting somewhere nearby. I would guess their larvae probably float, you know, a good distance, but do you believe that there is an impact potentially on the shellfish ecology of the area due to this discharge?
No, the main concern why the limit is so low for shellfishery is the human consumption. And so shellfish are filter feeders, and so they can accumulate the bacteria and for a limited time give that bacteria and viruses an opportunity of further growth. And so that's why the limit, it concentrates potential pathogens. And so at strictly a human health standard, I don't expect that those pathogens would affect the shellfish ecosystem itself.
Okay, so then just to conclude on this track, from my understanding as a layperson in this area, would you agree that the impact of the discharge or the potential would relate closely to how many people are recreationally harvesting in that area or the frequency of that activity? Because if no one's there, no one's going to get hurt by eating the shellfish, right?
So the act of consumption or shellfish harvesting, that's not part of the beneficial uses. And so we're talking about the potential harm for the beneficial uses. And so that would be an example of actual harm where somebody ate a contaminated shellfish and got sick from it. That would be strong evidence that this discharge was harm. We don't have that in this case. However, we're supposed to be protecting the existing beneficial uses.
Okay. My next question is the same regarding water recreation. That's one of the two beneficial uses we're concerned with. Is there a lot of water recreation going on in this area of impact, or a very little bit, or you have no?
There's a lot in this region. It's a state beach, and there's also Rincon Point, which is a world-famous surfing area. So there's a lot of water contact recreation in this zone.
Okay, thank you. Leo Sarmiento, you mentioned that for up to 25 years ago, Palo Alto's waste treatment plant had a a chlorine pump alarm, right? I just wanted to confirm that it's the same kind of pump alarm that wasn't present in this case.
The alarm that was present in Palo Alto was the low chlorine dose alarm, and they don't have that in this particular facility.
Okay, and that relates then to my next question. Thank you. I thought you said that it would be ill-advised, that wasn't your quote, but basically what I got out of it is it would be ill-advised if the chlorine's levels in the tank at the time of this incident were low. Did you say something like that?
There should be an alarm for a low-level chlorine residual.
And I wasn't aware until you mentioned that, that the chlorine levels might have been low at the time of incident. Is it that the chlorine stopped pumping into the tank and that's why they were low?
That's a possibility. There could be other issues, but mainly it's loss of chlorination.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe the district will clarify on that when they have a chance. My next question is for staff. You mentioned toward the end of your presentation that the costs of several members of the prosecution team weren't included in the cost sought for recovery. My question is, why weren't they?
Well, I'm not sure that I actually have the knowledge to testify as to why they were not. Assistant Executive Officer Michael Thomas is not here today. I think, you know, the fact is there are several members, and if I were to speculate, I would say it was intended to keep the costs, you know, down into a reasonable level. You know, these things take a lot of time to prosecute. And so, you know, it was probably a way to try to mitigate the number of hours and the dollars keep racking up.
Right. Well, I would hope that the district was made whole in paying for, we have a lot of conflicting needs to spend our money, and if we're not recovering costs in this kind of a situation, I would not like to see only part of our costs recovered. So it was curious to me that we would not include all of the costs, so at least board would be aware of what the real costs were when we got to the point of making a decision here today. My very last question is to the staff here. If you had inventoried or polled all of the or many of the Central Coast treatment operations, and if you had found from that polling that most or all of them didn't have the chlorine alarm pump that is said to be industry standard in the presentation, would you still think it was industry standard?
Well, as Leo testified, alarms are very important, and particularly for permit compliance and notification of operators. So yes, in this case, particularly since chlorination is part of their unit processes, that we contend that is an industry standard to have an alarm system.
So if you pulled the closest 12 plants and none of them had it, you would maintain that this pump was still industry standard?
Yes, and then we would also write them all a notice of violation that they're failing to maintain safeguards in their permit and expect them to correct that deficiency.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you. So my question is for Mr. Sarmiento. So you're a licensed plant operator?
25 years ago.
Okay. And what was the level of your license?
Grade 3.
Level 3?
Yes.
How many levels are there?
There are 5.
5 levels. And in order to maintain a license as an operator, does it require taking an exam?
Yes.
Does that exam include questions associated with monitoring level of chlorination for disinfection purposes?
I don't recall, but it might include certain levels of safety. There are safety questions that they pose, like, for example, if there's a spill of a chemical or a hazard, what's going to be a reaction? Those types of questions may be in the exam, but it varies on what level you're taking, grade 1, grade 2, up to grade 5.
Okay. And so I would assume that the questions are based on the standard manual, operator's manual, and their expected competency at the various levels. So do you recall if the training manuals do cover alarm systems, monitoring systems?
Yes.
For chlorination?
Yes.
So it does include that?
Yes.
And in order to maintain your license, do you have to take continuing education classes?
There are, yes. At that time, it was not required. I don't know if it's required now, but it is equally important to have continuous training and education.
And I would assume there are associations that do provide ongoing training for operators.
Yes, there were.
In order to assure they maintain their license. Do you know a couple of names of some of these?
CWEA is one of them that has conferences and training programs for operators.
And could you spell what an acronym means?
Oh, the California Water Environmental
Association.
Association.
Yeah. Association. Yeah. So in the course of their training for their members, do these training programs also do cover the importance of alarm systems?
I don't think so. They have a very they have different aspect or subject matters.
Mm-hmm.
It deals with effective operations and also safety.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Harris?
Mr. Mayor Delgado just asked the question about surveying other wastewater treatment plants and said that if you found that 12 didn't have them, would you be treating this the same way? And your answer was, well, we'd write them up for a violation of not having safeguards. This plant's been inspected multiple times. Has this plant ever been written up under that portion of their permit for not having an alarm?
Not that I know of.
Okay. Did the prosecution team do any modeling of the plume? You had a nice slide that showed how it floats, and I just wonder if you did any near shore modeling of where that might have gone onto shore concentrations. I don't know if there are models that even do that.
I reviewed the model that the district used, and I applied that model to a certain extent to understand why it was saying it was diluting beyond my expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I looked at the general research and literature to estimate what the far field dilution factors would be and the time frame that occurs over hours. So I didn't do a mathematical model of that dilution process, but I reviewed that in a general sense.
Was the beach ever posted? Now, you said this occurred near a state beach, is that correct?
Correct.
Was that beach ever posted or closed because of this spill?
It was not.
Southern California has a history of problems with bacteria and beach closures, a lot due to stormwater, rain events, and that kind of things. And there's a lot of work going on in terms of trying to make the monitoring much more timely, but it's pretty common to go out and post beaches to close them to protect public health. So I'm wondering, why do you have any sense of why this one was not posted?
I did not talk to the public health official for Santa Barbara County, so I don't know why the day after he didn't take any further action. In an open shore environment like this, we would expect the plume and the discharge to loop relatively rapidly. And if it was an enclosed bay, that would be in a different situation. We also reviewed the monitoring data from the beach itself, and there was a water quality sample taken at the beach 5 days after the event that we included as part of our evidence, and that showed a standard background level of bacteria.
So bacteria in a marine environment, I'm not a biologist, but does it die off faster than, say, in freshwater, or is it more a matter of dilution in terms of discharges of treated effluent to the ocean?
dilution is much more an important process in these environments than the actual persistence, or what do we call the half-life of the bacteria and the viruses in the ocean environment.
So if the I think what you're saying is you don't think there was any issue with bacteria at the beach, because more than likely in that turbulent environment there would have been sufficient mixing to protect public health. Where would the REC, and I think we're talking about REC 1 standard, where would the REC 1 standard, where would the potential harm for REC 1 be occurring?
So that REC 1 standard, that zone is defined from 1,000 feet offshore or to the 30-foot depth contour. So that range that we're talking about to the breaking waves, I believe the concentrations were likely exceeded for water recreation. Within the surf zone itself, like I said, there would have been more rapid dilution that would lower that exposure level.
So if I'm out in the water swimming, in theory, their outfall is at 25 feet. So what it's saying is, if I swim out 1,000 feet and I go down 25 feet, I should be protected under REC 1, and that in the that is where a violation.
That is incorrect.
The potential harm is all the way out there, so I should be able to swim in that entire area without worrying about my health.
No, that's incorrect. Okay. So there's a mixing zone, and within that mixing zone, the receiving water limits don't apply. So, but once you're outside of that mixing zone, you have the receiving water limits, and it's our contention that that plume would have likely exceeded the water recreation. So that zone from 1,000 feet to the surf zone, which is typically a couple hundred feet, I believe there would have been an area where that plume would have traveled and violated, likely violated the receiving water limits.
So I looked through the permit last night. I don't recall seeing is the mixing zone defined in the permit as an actual numeric spatial volume of water?
No, it's understood that the mixing zone is where those turbulent forces, the buoyancy and momentum changes that entrains the ocean water and rapidly mixes, that's the mixing zone. Typically in a situation this where there's a shallow outfall near the shore, I believe that mixing zone will be essentially at 100 feet around the outfall.
Okay, all right, thank you.
I have a few questions. The $300 economic benefit or savings for failure to have an alarm, that's based on the delay costs and not the cost of purchasing the alarm. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then on the $22,000 in staff costs, there's a table in part of the prosecution team's submittal that lists the tasks and hours. And I think it says it's based on an estimate of the time spent on this matter. What are those estimates based on, and how do you track your time?
So those estimates are based on my work, Leo Sarmiento's and Jim Fisher's hours that they spent to conduct this investigation. We don't have a formal tracking process, but those are estimates based on our meeting notes and times where we come up with that estimate of hours that we worked on it.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is now an opportunity for the defense to ask questions.
May I ask if we can take a quick break before we start the defense?
Yes, absolutely. So let's make, can we make it 10 minutes? All right, so we'll reconvene at 5 to 11. Good idea, thank you.
Please remember to use your mics. If you don't use your mic, it won't be on the recording devices.